Hello, it's the Religion and Ethics Report, Andrew West with you, on this Christmas Eve. In a moment, we'll hear from one of Australia's most popular writers. Hugh McKay is also our most astute reader of public opinion, and he's been reflecting in his latest book on the importance of finding a place to belong. Now, that's especially so in a world increasingly fractured by technology and just the frantic pace of life. We'll visit Hugh McKay in the heart of the community where he's chosen to settle. But before we go there, Pope Francis may be a role model of humility and simple living, but he's been energetic, even audacious, in his efforts to reform the Vatican, and now it seems global affairs. We heard recently that Francis had been instrumental in forging an historic rapprochement between the United States and Cuba. It turns out that the Vatican, with its extensive diplomatic networks, wrote to Barack Obama and Cuban leader Raul Castro, urging a thaw in relations after more than 50 years of Cold War. Well, now we learn that instead of giving his top Vatican bureaucrats an end-of-the-year pat on the back and a Christmas greeting, he used the gathering to attack the Vatican culture, including a culture of wealth and gossip and vanity. But we shouldn't be surprised, according to Austin Ivory. He's the author of a new biography, certainly the most comprehensive to date, of the Pope, who was previously known as Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio. The book's called The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. I spoke with Austin Ivory earlier from Oxford, and we started with the Pope's role in Cuba.
He goes to Cuba in 1998. Pope John Paul II made his historic visit to Cuba then. And he was asked afterwards, Bergoglio was, to write a book about the speeches and so on. And he has a very interesting, the first part of his book is a denunciation, actually, very clearly, of both neoliberalism and of communism. And it's straightforward Catholic social teaching, and I think that's always where he was, and he was there in the 1970s as well. It's just a different political context. His duty is to speak out. His duty is also to hold the state to account. But yes, he's a ferocious critic of corruption, of free market idolatry, and basically he's always speaking continually from the point of view of the unprotected, the powerless poor. He's not in any way in opposition to the market as a means of generating wealth, of course not, but he is critical of a certain mentality which justifies doing nothing about poverty in the expectation that the market will one day deliver wealth for everybody. And he keeps pointing out that this, as a theory, is just bunkum. The poor just get poorer, the unemployed remain unemployed. As he said, the so-called trickle-down effect is not that the water fills up the glass and then it trickles over. The glass just gets bigger and the water never does trickle down. So that's what he's critical of. So what does he think the state should do? How much should the state intervene in the economy? Well, he doesn't go into those things. But what he does have is a very strong notion, and I go through all his great Te Deum homilies and these annual celebrations where he holds the government to account in Argentina, where he's actually outlining a very sophisticated project for the revitalization of politics from civil society. Actually, some of the richest thought of any Catholic leader I've ever read was Bergoglio in Argentina following the collapse of the state in 2001, if you like, laying out a vision for that renewal of politics.
What is his reform agenda? Because, okay, it's not social liberalism, it's not that. So what is it then? Just a softening of rhetoric? Is it just less public judgment?
It's this. He believes that people should come to know the loving mercy of God. They should come to know themselves, the healing, if you like, loving part of God and the church. And he believes that at the moment, that's not what people see in the church. So his vision of the church is very, very clearly articulated in his documents and in his interviews, is he wants the church, he likens it to being a battlefield hospital. He wants the church to be in the margins of society, wherever there is need and hunger and poverty and powerlessness. He believes the church should be there, healing and bringing people the loving, saving mercy of God, and should open up its doors much more, be less concerned with regulation and just much more accompanying people. That is his vision. It's a vision developed throughout his life in Argentina. And he's really convinced that, you know, from a lifetime being soaked in meditation and contemplation of the gospel, that is what God is calling the world to. And that's what he wants the church to offer. It is radical and it's extremely disconcerting for those people who, if you like, have relied for too long on a certain model, if you like, of clarity, of doctrinal clarity. Actually, he says doctrinal clarity isn't enough. We have to offer the heart of God before we offer the wisdom.
will you say he has not altered a single core doctrine? So what's all the fuss about then?
Well, partly it is a misreading of him. So in a secular liberal modern media tends to regard the problem with the Catholic Church as being its doctrine. So here you have a pope who's shaking things up, who is popular, who appeals to people. And so there's a kind of quick conclusion that, oh, well, what he's probably doing is modernizing Catholic doctrine. But he's not. He's filling it out. He's showing the side of Catholic doctrine which we often don't see or the world doesn't see. And it's surprising them, and they think that it's therefore a kind of a change of doctrine. But it's not. It's just they haven't seen it before. He does represent change, and he does represent a challenge to those people who a conservative kind of Catholicism, which does rely too much, if you like, on doctrinal clarity, because he's a man above all who speaks to the heart, he's a man of action, who crosses boundaries and so on. But it's core gospel radicalism. It's not, you know, progressive liberal notions of what Catholicism should be. You know, under this pope, you will not see, you know, women priests. You will not see the doctrine of contraception change. You will not see, you know, in fact, his whole effort at the moment through the Synod on the Family is how to strengthen the Christian understanding of marriage, indissolubility and all the rest of it. So you will not see any changes to core Catholic doctrines. What you will see is a much greater flexibility on the part of the church in reaching out to people and a much more missionary focus. So in other words, taking the church out. You know, one of his great images, and he used it on the eve of the conclave, but I also show in the book, he used it at a retreat a few months earlier, is he said, you know, the problem is not that kind of Jesus is knocking and we need to let him in. The problem is that we've got Jesus tied up in the sacristy. We need to let him out, you know. So it's all about taking the church out onto the street, to the margins, as he famously says, to the existential peripheries. That is the whole focus of his pontificate. And even though there are very important things happening which he has triggered in Rome in terms of reform of the curia and the finances, all this stuff is necessary and important, but it's not the heart of the pontificate. It's not the heart of the reform. The reform is bringing the world closer to know the saving, loving, healing, merciful love of God.
But just very quickly, you say, no, we won't see women priests. I think he's with his predecessors who've said, yes, the door is closed on that. On the question of contraception, maybe a little more turning of a blind eye. I mean, even Benedict said there was some occasion, some justification for the use of condoms, for example. And he's said some things about the Eastern Church's model of married priests, which has hinted that maybe he might accept some form of married clergy.
Yeah, I do think married clergy, whether in this pontificate or in a future one, is actually fairly likely, because I mean, we have now so many, anyway, married priests within the Catholic Church, former Anglicans, for example, in my country, but the Eastern Rite churches and so on. But that's not a Catholic doctrine. That's a discipline, a tradition, which I think indeed could well be changed. Actually, a lot of these debates are very much, and I'm going to cause lots of offence here, but I mean, they are elite Western concerns. They're not actually, you know, where the Catholic majority is. That's not their core concerns. What's the first thing he does as Pope is he goes to Lampedusa, the island south of Italy, and speaks about the tragedy of migrants drowning at sea. He then goes to Sardinia to talk about joblessness, you know, jobs and migration. These are his primary concerns because they're the concerns of the poor.
Tell us the lovely line that he used the moment that he accepted the papacy.
He said, "I accept even though I am a great sinner." And this, of course, is him speaking as a Jesuit who has used to be in the 1970s a great spiritual master. What's the first thing we need to understand about ourselves? Both that we are a sinner, we are, in other words, in need of God, but on the other hand, we are unconditionally loved and forgiven. And it's in the recognition of those two things that the journey of conversion can begin, right up to the moment of it. As Pope, he knows he's a sinner. It's a wonderful humility.
Austin Ivory, the author of The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. Austin, thank you so much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
It's been great to be with you, Andrew. Thanks so much.
And you're with Andrew West, and you can hear a longer version of that interview focusing on the Pope's politics in the new year.